Is suffering a part of all human experience? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author. We're continuing a 13-week series on the New Testament epistles of 1st and 2nd Peter. My conversation partners throughout this quarter are Dr. Alden Thompson and Dr. Jody Washburn, both professors of Old Testament at Walla Walla University. Is suffering a part of your experience? Has it been?
Yes.
Any specific times of suffering that you'd like to share? Are there moments that have been difficult that come to mind that have helped you grow or have left scars? Maybe things you're comfortable saying.
Maybe all of the above.
All of the above.
It's very difficult. You know, there's suffering and then there's suffering. And I don't know to what extent we can look at our suffering and say it served a meaningful purpose beyond ourselves. We're going to be talking about the suffering of Jesus, and that clearly has a larger goal. But does my suffering, our suffering, have that same kind of purpose?
Sometimes isn't that the question we ask about suffering? What's the purpose of this? Why am I going through this? Whether it's a broken relationship, losing someone that we love, the challenge of physical suffering through an illness, a loss of a limb, a terminal illness.
And of course, I think Romans 8:28, that God is at work in all things to bring about what is good. I'm not enough of a Calvinist to say that all things work together for good, mm-hmm. but that marginal reading, which is there in a number of translations, is that God works in all things. Mm. And in recent months, I've been quite intrigued. I think I've mentioned this before. The C.S. Lewis quotation, he says, I will not believe in the managerial God and his general laws. If there is a providence at all, everything is providential, and every providence is a special providence. That has forced me to think through every issue, and in some ways it's very helpful, kind of like praying without ceasing. You ask, all right, now what, Lord, do you want me to learn from this? So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, probably the most difficult suffering was the vicarious suffering because of my wife's illness. Mm-hmm. You can't do a thing about it.
Yeah. See?
Or the other one was when I was academic dean. That was just pure torture.
You know? a role that you didn't want to take on.
Yeah. And, you know, I would, in the morning, I would just be wrenched with sobs. Now, my temperament is such that I usually come back, you know, bounce back fairly quickly. And those who were sure I hadn't learned my lesson yet said, we better hit Thompson a bit harder, you know, and it was, you know, 4 years of that taught me a lot, but I've never had any fear of authority. Hmm. The president makes a mistake, I'll tell him, you know. Well, all of a sudden, the people treat me as if I was some kind of a plague, you know. I would speak just wanting to be an outspoken faculty member like I always had been, but I learned you can't do that when you're, 'cause when the dean speaks, you know, people take it seriously. Mm. Even though they shouldn't, mm. see.
And it's hard when we're in a position that we're not comfortable or where other people make that role difficult for us. When we think about the suffering of Jesus, surely there are times in his life, certainly in his ministry, where the mistreatment of other people, especially the Pharisees, would have been hard for him to bear. Gospel of John begins by saying he came to those who were his own and his own received him not. How difficult that would be to be part of, incarnate in and among his own people, those he came to save, and they didn't want to have anything to do with him. But when we look at the end of Jesus' life, most people, when they talk about the sufferings of Christ, they talk about his Gethsemane experience and his crucifixion. In my studies of crucifixion, I don't want to go into all the details. It's incredibly hard to study. It's very gory. But the fact of crucifixion is that the Romans had perfected a form of torture that took 3 days to die, where a person would, by hanging on a cross, basically it would cause their muscles in their chest to cramp up, and they would stop being able to breathe unless they pushed up against the nails, take a breath. Actually, that allowed them to exhale, and then they could rest back down, inhale again, and then they would have to push up, causing all the pain again to breathe. Jesus would have died on Sunday or Monday if he were truly dying of crucifixion. Instead, Jesus was dead within hours. And that's the part of crucifixion that I look at and I think, well, Jesus was crucified, certainly, and I don't want to diminish the pain of crucifixion, but something else was happening on the cross. And so my question, if Jesus' death was less one of crucifixion than of separation from his Father, why do Christians make the cross such a central symbol of Christianity? Why does the cross take front and center stage when it's a Roman object of torture, and it wasn't the object of torture that killed Jesus ultimately? It was something else. What does that fact, the fact that Jesus was crucified, teach us then, if he didn't die of it?
Well, when it comes to the atonement, understanding what the cross means, it's quite clear that Jesus elected to give his life, and he read the Old Testament not for the conquering king passages, but for the suffering servant. And that's precisely what nobody wanted to believe. Nobody wanted to believe the Messiah was going to suffer and die.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until after the resurrection that all of a sudden the lights came on. They said, oh, that's what that means.
They went back and reread Isaiah 53, like right. A lamb led to the slaughter.
But nobody, as far as we can tell, nobody applied that to the Messiah before his death.
Before, correct, yeah.
It seems the cross is a symbol, perhaps, even if it's not directly, like you're saying, related to the way that he died. But seeing him on the cross is a symbol of his own submission. If he came to give himself as an illustration of the character of God, right, the self-giving love that is the character of God, then him submitting to that symbol of Roman power, I think in a way is symbolic, even if that wasn't the cause of his physical death. And then, of course, his willingness, right? One text in the Bible says he gave up the ghost, right? It's almost like the picture of him letting go of his life.
And there's a sense also in which the cross illustrates the horrendousness of human capability to cause suffering in others, and that people would actually stoop to such a level to seek the death, not just the death, but the horrific death of the author of life. The contrast. The deep irony within the great controversy picture that here you have God seeking to save people. He saved others. Himself he cannot save. And here the people, whether they were incited by the devil or not, I think people have become so callous to suffering in others that they're willing to inflict it on those they don't like. And here's Jesus suffering for it, one who was without sin, and he's dying at the hand of others.
You mentioned the reference from the gospel where he saved others, but himself he cannot save. And I wonder, too, if there are other aspects to that, like he chose not to save. He needed not to save himself because his identity is not tied up in his power against any given earthly kingdom, but in this much broader, long-lasting.
The kingdom of heaven,
yes.
where he's fighting against a spiritual battle that needs to come to an end so that the kingdom of heaven can go on forever in us,
yes,
or with us.
But if you take a look at that famous passage in Philippians 2 where he emptied himself,
yeah,
and became a servant, there is a sense in which Jesus' temptations during his life were much more serious than ours.
No question. Yeah, when we think about the temptations of Jesus in the wilderness, he was asked to do things there's no way that I could or would think about giving into.
Yes.
Right? Turning bread, stones into bread. Throwing myself off the top of a tall building to be caught by angels, to worship the devil outright and to be given the kingdoms of the world. I've never been offered the kingdoms of the world. Have you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We see the death of Jesus, but Peter, of course, began his epistle with a promise of the blessed hope. And the question comes then to really ask about the hope that we have, that if Jesus could be raised from the dead, then maybe we can too. So I'm curious to know from both of you, how do you reconcile your faith in the resurrection with science that cannot prove resurrection possible? So what evidence might there be that life itself is a miracle to start with, and that resurrection isn't any more implausible than life starting by the hand of some kind of a designer? Now, I know there are people who would argue that science suggests that life came about through through spontaneous arrival of some kind of life, and yet the psalmist says, "I am fearfully and wonderfully made, put together." Right? Is resurrection something you have personal hope in, and is there a sense in which Jesus' resurrection is something we can believe in spite of science not giving us daily evidence that resurrection is possible?
I think I see myself as an incurably religious person. I have never faced, well, I know the crucial questions. The kind of tension which C.S. Lewis describes, he says, when you're a believer, sometimes this present world shouts out at you as if that's all there is. And he says, how well I remember when I was an atheist, I would wake up in a cold sweat and maybe old tales are true after all. And he talks about this fifth columnist in the soul. I've never faced that. So I don't need any proof. Jesus says that he will give life to us. And while I have never seen the kind of perfect world represented by Isaiah 11, the vegetarian kingdom, the wolf shall live with a lamb, the leopard shall lie down with a kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together. Nobody's ever seen a world like that. But somehow, in our hearts, we sense that it needs to be that way. Because if God's going to make a kingdom, it needs to be a peaceful kingdom when nobody eats anybody else. See? Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty crucial.
And not just the eating, but the taking of a life in general. And Isaiah 65 then recapitulates that theme in a new kingdom. Is resurrection something you're comfortable with, Jody, when you think about science? Is it something you have personal hope in as well?
I just think there are so many miracles. We look all around and there are miracles. And perhaps that's showing my own, like Alden saying, you know, we come to the world with a spiritual understanding of reality, that there's something more than just the natural atoms and molecules. But I see bits of evidence everywhere, whether it's just the breath in my own lungs in the morning when I wake up, or children and how they notice everything and take it all in. I feel like there's plenty of evidence around us to look for a reality beyond the natural
world. Yeah, we certainly have some hope. And Jesus' story, of course, doesn't conclude just with his ascension, but it concludes with a blessed hope, his promise to come again. And I hope for the three of us and all of you who are listening today that blessed hope of Jesus coming back to life and promising to come again is a very real living hope for you. Next week, we're going to consider the book of 2 Peter. But for now, I want to say thank you to my colleagues, Alden Thompson, Jody Washburn. Also, my thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer, and to all of you who are listening in for the Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.